Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to this conversation with Greg Knight. You'll be hearing a lot more from him than you will from me. I'm going to ask a few questions to start with, as soon as the boom has been sorted out. Yep. And then it'll be over to you. Well, there's a small charge for making a LSE furniture, which we'll levy later. Now, what we're going to talk about mainly is Greg's book, which amazingly I have read because I was asked to review it. And so I have done. And later on, he's going to be signing copies. And while I do a little brief character assassination of Greg, he's going to start practicing by signing mine with a pen, which he hasn't brought, so he can borrow mine. Now, Greg began life with two major handicaps. One was that he didn't go to the LSE. He went instead to York, but he has more or less sorted that out because his partner and mother of his children is Sue Howes, who is an alumna of the LSE. So that handicap has been resolved. The second handicap, which he hasn't been able to do anything about, is that he is one of that unpleasant species called a Cockney Red. In other words, a Manchester United supporter. As people know, there aren't any Manchester United supporters in Manchester, but there are quite a lot in London. And since I'm a Manchester City supporter, that has established a certain kind of distance between us throughout our lives and caused quite a number of unpleasant events to take place on the football field where we used to play together every week for about 15...
Long time.
Probably 15 years. Mm. However, we aren't going to talk about football. We're going to talk about the BBC, the interaction between the media and politics, about the Iraq War, about Gilligan, about weapons of mass destruction, and all that. And Greg, as you know, was appointed Director General of the BBC under this regime. And when he was appointed, the Times ran a campaign against his appointment on the basis that he was one of Tony's cronies. And it's somewhat ironic, therefore, the way things turned out. And when the war started and the flak around the Gilligan report started, the Tony's crony ancestry didn't seem to help a great deal. And of course, the famous 6 a.m. broadcast where Gilligan talked about the dodgy dossier and all that began a great unraveling, which involved the sad death of Dr. Kelly and eventually Greg's departure from the BBC in unhappy circumstances, and all of that is now recorded in this book. So the key question is, Greg, do you agree with Arsene Wenger that Ruud van Nistelrooy is a cheat?
I was on the board of Manchester United at the time when Rupert Murdoch tried to buy it. And I was leading the campaign on the board against selling to Rupert Murdoch or to Sky. And that evening I went out for dinner with him. And he sat there and looked at me and said, "I hope they buy it." So I said, "Why?" He said, "Because Manchester United was born at Munich and it'll die under Murdoch." So you mustn't take him too seriously about football.
Now, look, with respect,
if you've been watching Manchester City for 20 years, you can't be too serious about football.
With respect, yes. Greg, I really think we should talk about Iraq and the BBC.
Yes, right.
Now, the underlying issue, it seems to me, was that the government strongly believed that the BBC's reporting of the Iraq war was biased against the war from the start. Do you think that was right?
That they believed that, or that it was?
Yeah, that they believed it, and do you think it was?
No, all the academic studies since actually have shown the opposite. If anything, we were a bit favoured the other way. I was a bit worried about embedded reporters all the way through because I thought embedded reporters are only going to get one side of this. All governments at times of war believe that the BBC should be on their side. And you can go right the way back to Suez. You can probably go back to the Second World War, but certainly at Suez, Sir Anthony Eden seriously discussed taking over the BBC because the BBC allowed the leader of the opposition, Hugh Gaitskell, to go on and explain why Labour was against the war. And that has happened to almost every conflict since. And what happened in this time was that Alistair Campbell decided very early on that the BBC, if he could persuade us, should not report properly those who believe that the war was wrong. And that's perfectly legitimate. It's perfectly legitimate for governments to try to do that. But it's also would be very wrong if the BBC folded. So that sort of tension is always there. It was there more so in this time because I think you have to deal with the personality of Alistair Campbell within all that.
So you were aware of that concern. And did you communicate that to the journalist down the line and said, be careful because we know that that is the government's mindset?
No. What I said to the journalist down below is be fair, do it properly, but do what we have to say. But we were aware of that. Oh, yes. I mean, look, there were 2 million people. What they tried to convince us was that we were not reporting properly and that we had an agenda against the war. And what I wrote a pretty... And eventually I got a letter from Blair saying precisely that. And I wrote back and said, I'm sorry, but you and Alistair Campbell cannot be the judges of impartiality. I mean, look at the shit you're in. You know, you've got 2 million people walking on the streets of London. You've got demonstrations going on all over the country. You can't judge impartiality. We have to judge that. Now, what I did do was set up a group, which I'd done previously in other times, which I did during Afghanistan, was I set up a group that met every morning and discussed our coverage of the war. And we discussed all sorts of things, and sometimes we were concerned. We were concerned that our phone-ins were getting dominated by anti-war people. We were concerned that the audience for Question Time was being dominated by anti-war people. It was quite difficult, actually, to find people who were in favour of the war, even though the polls showed quite clearly it was a 50-50 split. So we took action on all those things, and therefore I deeply resented then getting this letter from the Prime Minister.
And that was before the famous Gilligan...
Oh, that was long before that. This was the week the war started.
Yeah.
And it was quite clear he was put up to it by Campbell. And as we understand it later, he rather regretted sending it because he got a pretty rude reply back. I mean, he started off saying, I don't mean to be rude. Well, you know when you write that, that means you're going to be rude.
So you had this morning meeting. So at the morning meeting after the famous 10 past 6...
No, that was long. We stopped the morning meeting.
You stopped the morning meeting.
So once the war was over.
So you didn't have a morning meeting on the...
Not the 7 minutes past six. Okay. No. Right. I was on holiday in Ireland. I wasn't up at 7 minutes past six.
So when did you first hear that?
Well, actually, there was another big story going on that week, which rather dominated my holiday in Ireland, which was whether or not correspondents should run a documentary which showed the bodies of English soldiers who'd been killed in the war. And that rather dominated the week. And it was a tough decision. I was away, but I was being kept informed. In the end, Jane Abellett, who's the director of television, decided we should show the pictures. And I was just about, I think, agreed with that. The governors at a later stage disagreed. But it was a very close call. The BBC had never done it before. That's what we discovered. But actually, we were showing a documentary that showed dead Iraqis and dead Americans, and I couldn't see why we shouldn't show dead British soldiers. But obviously the families were upset, and it was quite... I mean, this was a five-second clip. But that dominated that week.
But when did you...
So I got back onto work on the Monday.
Yeah.
When I first discovered there was a bit of a hoo-ha going on, but it wasn't that much of a hoo-ha.
And at that time, did you listen to it?
No, I said to the head of editorial policy, who I was meeting with on the Tuesday or something, go investigate this and find out if this is serious or not. And he came back and said it was a good story, well sourced.
But you didn't listen to it yourself?
No, I listened to it a week or so later.
And did you ask about the sources?
I did when we got the letters of complaint.
And you were able then to satisfy yourself that the sources were adequate?
I didn't ask for the name of the source, but I said to the head of news, do you know the source? And he said, yes. I mean, you've got to be very careful in these things. There's a limited number of people who ought to know the name of the source. I found out a couple of weeks later, but I said, do you know the name of the source? Is this a reliable source? And then I said, what is his role? So I knew the role, but I didn't know the name.
But one in the book, the one thing that you say you think should have been done differently was that at some point, and I can't remember precisely which point, you said you should have ordered an internal review of the circumstances of this broadcast, etc. At what point should you have done that, and why did you not?
Well, you've got to remember what happened. We got two or three letters of complaint, two from Alistair Campbell, and what he was complaining about was quite interesting. He was complaining about that we hadn't followed our own guidelines by using a single anonymous source. Well, that's not true. If you look at the guidelines, it says in exceptional circumstances you can. And he complained that we didn't understand the role, or that the reporter hadn't understood the role of the Joint Intelligence Committee. We sent replies to those. We got another complaint, sent replies to those. And in the second one, we invited Alistair Campbell to take the whole thing to the complaints process if he wanted to. That we were very happy to do that. And then it went dead. Disappeared for 2 weeks. Never story never heard of again. We all thought it had gone away, like so many do. When suddenly Alistair Campbell goes before the Foreign Affairs Committee, under a lot of pressure, because the Foreign Affairs Committee was really wanting to know about the other dossier, the one he nicked off the internet. His people had nicked off the internet, sexed up and put out pretending it was intelligence, and done it so well that even Colin Powell said it was a great contribution towards the debate. And Powell clearly was in trouble going to the Foreign Affairs Committee. And his solution to being in trouble was, you know, the good old PR solution that all good PR people do, which is hold your hands up quickly and attack somebody else. And that got all the headlines. And that's what got all the headlines. Now, after he'd done that, he wrote to us. He wrote me a letter that day, actually, which was a private letter, saying, I've always respected you, liked you, and the rest. It didn't mean to be nasty, to which I thought, well, I won't tell you what I thought. But he wrote a long letter to Richard Sandbrook, who was the head of news, saying, this is the, I want answers to this and this and this, you know, in that rather unpleasant way that he's got, this and this and this and this and this, and you lied and you lied and you lied. And what we should have done that day, and I demand a reply this afternoon, and what we should have done just that day, said, look, you're not going to get a reply this afternoon. Forget it. We will now set up an investigation and we'll come back to you in 3 months' time. But we didn't. We gave him what we thought was a comprehensive reply. And, of course, then he went nutty again. By this time, he was not entirely sane. But he went nutty. You know, that was the time when he went and walked, stormed into the Channel 4 news studio and sat there. And a really gripping interview with Jon Snow, who really gave him quite a hard time. But that's where we should have. I'm not sure it would have made any difference, but that's what we should have done at that stage. Just said, okay, we'll set up the investigation.
By whom?
Well, there's a discussion, isn't there, whether you ask your own internal people to do it or do you. I don't think at that stage it was a big enough story and a big enough issue to have had an outside investigation, so we'd have probably asked the internal complaints group to do it.
Anyway,
but let me tell you, I know exactly what they'd have come back with. Because they'd have had the same evidence that the news people all had before them. But, I mean, I think that would have calmed it down a bit. Well, I'm not sure they were calmable down at that stage.
And perhaps, given Kelly's death, they would have ordered a review anyway.
Well, Kelly's death came later, remember. That was 3-4 weeks later. I mean, the real thing that Campbell did was, and again, the trick of the PR man. You look at the original allegation, it talks about people in Downing Street who knew. People in government knew. It never said the Prime Minister at any stage. Campbell said, you've accused the Prime Minister of lying. And no matter how many times we said we're not, he went along with it. And to his discredit, the Prime Minister then joined in that and went along with it. Was it was never said, and the BBC must have said on three or four times, we never accused the Prime Minister of lying. I mean, we might do today. I mean, that's a debate today about whether you think the Prime Minister lied or not. I personally don't think he did. But we never accused the Prime Minister of lying at any stage.
So we then rolled on to the Hutton inquiry, and at that point,
you've got to look at this thing. It's a strange story because it died twice.
Yeah.
It died the second time after they'd named Hutton. Hutton goes before they'd named Kelly. Kelly goes before the Foreign Affairs Committee. I thought was treated appallingly, but I think that's how politicians do treat people in those circumstances. They're so used to that sort of antagonistic, unpleasant relationship with each other. They think that's how normal people speak. And I thought they treated him appallingly. But even then, the story was going. That would have been the end of it, except, of course, then, sadly, Dr. Kelly killed himself.
Mm. Well, the rest of that bit is quite well known. People may have their own questions to ask about it, but looking at the sort of longer-term implications of all this, there are implications perhaps for journalism, for the relationship between the government and the BBC, and indeed for the constitution, regulation, governance of the BBC. Let's focus on the first one, because your criticism of Hutton, apart from, as you saw it, the lack of balance in his distribution of the blame, if you like, was that he'd got the law wrong about journalism. And what you say is that he has established a new test, which is that things published or broadcast must be known to be true, and not just that there is a source on whom you have reason to believe knows what he's talking about. Now, that is the substance of your criticism of Hutton on the law, is it?
On the law, yeah. I've got many more criticisms of Hutton than that. But the criticism on the law is that he didn't understand the Reynolds judgment. He didn't understand qualified privilege. Dr. Kelly was an authoritative whistleblower within government, and therefore we were entitled to report him.
And you think that now what is interesting is it doesn't seem to have made much difference, does it, to the way the press is behaving? Do you think people are just ignoring?
Well, it's not. Remember, Hutton. It's not an interpretation because it's not a. It was an inquiry, not a law, not a judgment, and therefore it won't. If it had been a legal position, we could have appealed, and we'd have won on an appeal without any doubt. I mean, I had quite eminent lawyers in the House of Lords coming up to me and saying, I'd be happy to help fund you, represent you, and the rest of it to show that this is wrong. He got the law wrong. But he got quite a lot wrong. He didn't only get the law wrong.
And what else?
Well, he mentions, I think he talks about the 45-minute... you know, the threat that there are weapons of mass destruction that can be delivered in 45 minutes. I think he talks about it, I think there's 16 references in his report to it, and he never established what it meant. And actually, as soon as you'd established what it meant, you knew that something rather odd had gone on here. And of course, the following week after Hutton came out, we found out for real, because that rather smart Tory asked that clever question of the Prime Minister, and the Prime Minister was buggered. Because he had a choice. He either had to say, yes, I knew that the 45-minute threat only referred to battlefield weapons, and if that was the case, then there was no threat to British interests unless we invaded, which is the point Robin Cook makes in his book, in which case I lied, or I didn't know that, which is what he said, in which case I'm pretty incompetent because I took this country to war without asking the one profound question, i.e. I took this country to war on a piece of research, a piece of intelligence that said there were weapons of mass destruction that could be delivered in 45 minutes, and I never asked, what weapons are these? And the truth is, I think if you look at it, it was all a piece of PR. I mean, if you go back, the only intelligence basis on which I can explain the whole thing goes back to when Blair met Bush, March 2002. Blair, I think, at that stage decided that we would support the Americans if they invaded Iraq, and there is an argument for that. I mean, you can agree or disagree with it, but there is an argument for that, sticking with American foreign policy. And at that stage, Blair started talking about the threat of weapons of mass destruction. And Saddam Hussein's program for weapons of mass destruction had been started again and was active. Now, we now know from Butler there was absolutely no new intelligence to suggest that at all. But from the moment Blair said that, the intelligence services stopped being intelligence services and started being propaganda people. And they then rushed around to find the evidence to support what the Prime Minister was saying. And therefore, they then started going out to very unreliable sources, all of which were later withdrawn, although nobody ever told Lord Hutton they'd all been withdrawn, this intelligence. And they started grabbing hold of anything they could that supported the Prime Minister's position. And if you follow it all through like that, the dossier was irrelevant. It was just something that the Prime Minister wanted to put out to convince those of his party who were giving him a hard time and to convince some of the public to support his position. But he didn't believe it mattered. He believed there were weapons of mass destruction, because that's what he's like, you know, great zealot. He believed there were weapons of mass destruction, as did George Bush. Therefore, put out this dossier. And therefore, the dossier was a piece of propaganda. It was nothing else. It was not intelligence at all, as Butler showed quite clearly.
So you think the Prime Minister is not guilty of lying, but guilty of self-delusion?
Incompetence.
And yes. Incompetence.
Yes.
So
yes.
He should resign.
That's up for him. I find it interesting.
No, I'm just asking if you think he should resign. I know that's his decision.
Do I think he should have resigned?
Yeah.
Yes. I think when Butler came out, I think Butler thought he should have resigned as well. I mean, there was that wonderful piece that said Butler, the one question he was scared of anybody asking him at the press conference was, should the Prime Minister resign?
So you think he should have done after Butler?
I think if you run a company, you run the LSE, no? Huh? Well, so they tell me anyway.
We don't have any weapons.
And you wouldn't admit it either, would you? But you run the LSE. You go to your board with a profound policy change. You give it to your board. You have a whole paper that supports it.
Invading Iraq, say.
Yeah, just say invading. Right, but forget about it. You go to your board. Your board says, OK, Howard, we support you on this. You then go ahead and do it. It turns one into a disaster, which it is, and everybody can see it's a disaster. But secondly, when they start questioning you about your paper, they discover that not only did you not know what was in it hardly, you didn't ask any questions about it, you wouldn't survive a week. I mean, and that's what happened. That actually, it's not enough for Tony Kerr to keep saying, I was right. Yeah, he may have been right. Maybe it was a good idea to get rid of Saddam Hussein, but the reasons he did it and why he did it is not what he told us.
So you won't be voting Labour next time round?
No. No chance.
Can we just talk a bit about the... Before I throw it out, let me talk a bit about the BBC, because one interesting point... This is...
Now, what we should know is that we didn't know all this at the time
yes.
of Hutton.
No,
we only know this because of Butler.
I understand that. What I'm talking... What I want to move on to, though, is the way in which the BBC is governed. Because for many... I mean, for you, it's affected your life in a big way, and that's highly unfortunate, but... For many people, the question is, what should one then do to prevent this kind of car crash in the future, if you like? And we've discussed this relationship.
You can't prevent these sort of car crashes. Not only can't you, you shouldn't. But we have a different... In my letter to the Prime Minister, I said, we have different roles in a democracy. Now, this government doesn't want anybody else to have a different role in democracy. As Gavin Davis, my chairman, wrote in a very good article in The Guardian the other day, you know, this was the one bit of the fourth estate was the one bit left that was still scrutinising the government, because the opposition aren't doing it properly. The backbench Labour MPs aren't doing it properly. The press, whether you like it or not, I mean, in the period since then, as he pointed out in the article, the news, the Mail, The Guardian... The Observer, Today programme, and the television news are the people who are scrutinising what went on in this. Mm. The politicians aren't doing it. They all want it to go away.
But that's the point I was coming to. If you think that it is important to maintain that, then what about the role of the governors? Because you've described all this interaction with the government and the governor as if the governors weren't there. And they were supposed to be, in the constitution of the BBC, the people who were some kind of buffer. Between you and the government. That's what they're there for. They're there to protect the independence and integrity of the BBC. As far as one can see in this case, they didn't do any of those things.
That's not true. They did. They were very good up until Hutton. And then when Hutton came out, Gavin started talking about resigning as soon as we read it. Some of us were trying to persuade him not to. But he did it for very honourable reasons. And he watched the Prime Minister, and then he watched Alistair Campbell demand heads, and he then decided that there was no way there was ever going to be peace if somebody didn't go. So he decided to go. Now, that night, the governors met, and I think made a terrible mistake, but then I would, wouldn't I? I mean, and I think my position is irrelevant to it. The mistake they made was, I think they traded off the long-term future of the BBC with the position that Hatner had taken on a particular story. Now, I don't think there's any point having the BBC if it's not independent. We should close it down. There's no justification for it. And I thought that night they compromised its independence. And it's very interesting. I was last week in South Africa at a media stuff. 2 weeks earlier, I was in South Korea at a media stuff. Everywhere I go around the world, people believe the story is this. I was fired by the government who didn't like what we were saying about them. That's the feeling. Now, if that's the feeling out there, it's incredibly damaging to the BBC's independence and integrity. Incredibly damaging. Now, I don't think that's the feeling in this country, although I think there's a bit of it, because everywhere I go, for a long time, people keep coming up and saying, I'm sorry they got you. And I think, who do they mean by they? I don't know. Mm. But I'm sorry they got you.
But you do, in your book, draw some conclusions about the governance, and you don't take the view that it's fine.
No. Well, I increasingly came to the view while I was at the BBC that the system of governance doesn't work. And first of all, the sort of people get appointed to be governors of the BBC are disproportionately appointed because they're Welsh, Scottish, Irish, Black, Asian, a trade unionist, or something else. And they're not
that you have anything against any of these categories of people.
Well, if I was going to... I have nothing against them, but I don't think that's the basis for appointing people to be the board of the BBC. What I think you need for the board of the BBC is to say, what skills do we need on this board? And let's go out and find people who've got those skills. Now, you might then say, OK, let's make sure that there is an ethnic mix, let's make sure there's... But let's do that. Now, that's not what happens. What the BBC is made up of is, by and large, the classic, rather tedious, great and the good. As are many, many other institutions in this country. And that's what riddles this country with problems.
And you put Michael Grade in that category.
No, the chairmen are different. The chairman, I'm talking about the governors, I'm not talking about the chairman. Michael, if we hadn't had Hutton, if we hadn't had the bust-up, if the staff hadn't walked out, Michael had nil chance of becoming chairman of the BBC. The government was scared to death after what happened. I mean, when the staff walked out, when the unions demanded the government keep their hands off the BBC and organise a demonstration, when when half the newspapers, all the ones against, I mean, the newspapers, you've got to look at who was in favour of the war and who was against the war, and that'll tell you all the way through this. But when the Independent came out with whitewash the next day, I mean, that weekend, the government were absolutely shaken. I mean, I know people who sat with dinner that night with cabinet ministers who said, what do we do? We were found innocent. And nobody believes it. Well, they didn't believe it because they weren't innocent. But they didn't believe it because people had heard. I mean, the interesting thing about Hutton was he ran a very interesting open inquiry. So we all heard the evidence. And then he brings out a report that you wouldn't have known he'd been there. I mean, the person I'd like to... His QC, I thought, was brilliant. I'd love to know what his QC really thinks. Because you're never going to know, are you? But, I mean, Hutton's report was bizarre because it didn't reflect what people had heard or seen. It was just not possible that the BBC was guilty on every count and the government was guilty on none. It just wasn't possible. And, of course, we now know that nobody told him about the intelligence by then had been withdrawn. And it would be very interesting to see what, if you take Butler and give it to Hutton. But I think Hutton, if you want my opinion, Hutton was so far out of his depth. This is a Northern Ireland judge who'd only ever had one previous inquiry, and that was into the root of a river in Northern Ireland. He was way out of his depth. He was a diplock judge. He lived with the security services. They were with him non-stop. And he was clearly appointed because of that, not because he was going to be biased.
You have a story in your book that says that a Labour peer claims that Philip Gould told him that we'd chosen the right man so it'll all come out okay on the night he was chosen.
No, afterwards, I think.
Afterwards.
The Lord said to Philip Gould, are we going to be all right on this? And he said, yes, we chose the right judge. Now, Philip Gould, when that came out, went mad, threatened all sorts of people. But actually, we've never heard a word since.
You haven't had a writ.
There were some threats about the book. The publishers rightly said, go away, and we never heard another word.
Now, one puzzling thing about this, because there's obviously dysfunctional clash, which has damaged both sides. We have to, you know, the government's been damaged and the BBC's been damaged.
Well, hang on. Let's just look at the damage to the BBC. I think the BBC came out, in the end, stronger than it has been in years.
Yeah, but you've just said that overseas people think that they've...
Oh, it's damaged the reputation of the BBC. But in terms of the relationship with the government... Oh, no, it's certainly damaged... Well, that was the clash in the Hutton's report, yes. Well, and my departure.
My question is a slightly different one, is that this could have been... This was seen evolving as a very unpleasant story. And at the time, in Number 10 Downing Street, acting as, I think, director of strategy or something like that, was your predecessor, John Burt.
Yeah.
Now, why did he not see that this was an evolving crisis and intervene? He was the ideal man in the ideal position to try to sort this out. Why did that not happen?
John took the opposite view. John's view, which he made perfectly well known to a lot of people, was this story isn't true, and I know it's not true. And when you ask him, well, how did you know? When people asked him, how do you know it wasn't true? He said, because I'm inside here and everybody says it's not true. I think they even believed it wasn't true. See, that's the interesting thing. What happens, I think, I was talking to someone the other day. I draw the analogy in this between Watergate, between Nixon's White House and Blair's Downing Street. And I think in some cases the analogy is fair in the sense that, first of all, if you didn't agree with them, you're the enemy. Even if you were friends, you're still the enemy if you don't agree with them. And there's a load of people I could point you to who were involved in New Labour, the establishment of New Labour, who all feel now that they are seen as the enemy of Downing Street. If you read the language of Alistair Campbell's diaries, it could have been Ehrlichman or Haldeman inside Nixon's White House. You know, we're going to have to get these fucking bastards, fuck them, fuck them. This is the head of information for the whole of the British government. Oh, I'm going to fuck Gilligan.
You make sure, watch out, you may get a suit from Ehrlichman and Haldeman.
Yeah, no.
Standing citizens here.
Yeah, but they've both gone to God now, so they're all right. Most of you don't know about Ehrlichman and Haldeman. It's worth reading Watergate, because it's worth reading about what happens in government. Now, I think these guys believed, I mean, what they believed is anything signed off by John Scarlett was okay. Right? John Scarlett's head of the Joint Intelligence Committee. Anything signed off by John Scarlett was okay. And John Scarlett wanted to be the next head of MI6, which is the job he's now got. He'd sign off anything. And he did sign off anything. And the biggest villain of the whole scandal surrounding going to war in Iraq, or the dossier, is John Scarlett. And how John Scarlett can now be head of MI6, I cannot believe. Who in their right mind is going to believe anything that John Scarlett now signs off and sends to the government? Nobody. They can't do. I mean, because he signed off on stuff at Butler. I mean, if you see, take Butler. Butler has an account of, it's in the book, saying, this is what you could have said about the piece of intelligence relating to the 45-minute threat. If you read it, no one was going to put that into anything because it wouldn't convince anybody. It says, an unreliable source has reported that, but without any, you know, complete loads of caveats that basically says... Now, if you allow see what John Scarlett then allowed to go in, he should be ashamed of what he did. But, of course, he wasn't the only one. I mean, you know, John Scarlett, described in Alistair Campbell's diaries as my mate John. Now, should the chairman of the Joint Intelligence Committee really be the close mate of the head of information, the head of propaganda for the whole government?
I'm going to open it in just 2 seconds to you, but let me ask you one other thing. You say about the future of the BBC, you say in your book, the logic of the current system whereby the governors are both regulators and also responsible for management no longer holds water.
Yeah.
So what would you do instead?
Well, oddly, it might work, right? It could work, but it doesn't. But the intellectual basis for it doesn't stand up any longer. As soon as we've got into a society that is more and more demanding of accountability, you cannot have the same people being responsible for the management of the organisation and for the regulator, and be the regulator. And you can't for two reasons. You can't because for everybody out here, it doesn't make sense. Anyhow, how can you criticise? But also, it's deeply unfair to the people who work in the BBC. Because, I mean, when I worked in ITV, if the regulator came out with a report you didn't like, you just said, I don't agree. The BBC, you can't do that, because these are your bosses as well. Mm. So it doesn't stand up. What I would replace it with I'd just split it. I'd have a management board, a management and non-executive board running the BBC, and I'd have a small outside regulator regulating the BBC.
Why not Ofcom? That's what it's there for.
No, because the trouble is, if it becomes Ofcom, you end up having to weigh up all the time the commercial interests of a range of companies as against the public interest. And I suspect the commercial interest will win out, and they shouldn't do. And I think, in the end, Ofcom has to accept that it's a commercial regulator. It's interested in open competition, which the BBC is only to an extent. I just think what it would mean, you would never have been able to do the things that we think. I mean, the things that, one of the major contributions of the BBC in recent years, BBC Online, massive contribution, started by John, massive contribution. BBC Interactive, Freeview. If it had been regulated by Ofcom, it would have been stopped from doing all of those, I suspect. Because there were commercial interests against all of them. And they would have had too much sway.
Does it? I'd like my genuinely final question, and I'll throw it open. Does it occur to you as interesting that if you look back at your predecessors, and you, Bert, Checkland, Milne, Trethowen, as far back as I can think, of all their careers have all ended at the BBC in some form of disappointment, failure, being fired. And does that not cause you to think that maybe this is an impossible job and maybe the BBC is in itself too big, too important, that it just can't be run as one entity anymore?
No, I think what it means is that you have... If you're a governor of the BBC, you actually don't do a lot. There's not much to do. You don't run it. I don't even accept that they've defended the independence and the integrity of the BBC over the years. There's a wonderful quote in the book I found from Michael Grade, who was on Question Time soon after the whole Gilligan affair, basically saying when he was director of television there, they were at the time when all the bus stops were going on over Northern Ireland, that the governors would fold at the slightest hint. It's the culture and staff of the BBC who have made it independent, not the governors.
My question was about the Director General, not whether that job is impossible, suggesting that the structure of the corporation is just overblown.
No, the Director General doesn't run the BBC. The Director General makes strategic position. I mean, it was very funny going before Hutton and saying, you're the editor-in-chief of the BBC. Well, you're not. You're the chief executive of the BBC. The editor-in-chief of News was News. The editor-in-chief of BBC One is the person who runs BBC One and the rest of it. You're not. It's the job of the Director General is about strategy, really. It's about long-term strategy. You know, medium-term, long-term strategy. What are you going to do? What are you going to do the rest of it? Now, the trouble is, if you're quite high profile as I was, even before I got there, you know, then you get pinned on you by the press, everything. You make every decision at the BBC. According to the press, I made every decision. I mean, when I tell you I commissioned one programme in 4 years, and that was a two-part documentary on Nelson Mandela, and I only happened to that because I had a way into Mandela. And I decided I would commission it, and I wasn't sure that BBC One wanted it, so I commissioned it anyway. Because I think that's what you do every so often. But that's all I did. And every so often you say, look, I think we're going too far that way, or we haven't got enough of that, or we need more of this. But also a lot of the time is spent on things like planning, you know, Freeview was an interesting opportunity, which we took, going unencrypted and taking our whole service away from Sky. and those sorts of things, which are all about long-term strategy. I mean, my fear, which I cited in the book, was that Rupert Murdoch would control the digital world in this country, and I thought that was incredibly unhealthy for our society. And actually, Fairview stopped that. And that was, if I look back at what I did, that's the most important thing I did. Mm. It stopped that dominance, because this government wasn't going to stop it, because this government folded to Murdoch in about 19, well, before they got elected.
Over to you. First, enthusiastic hand, right in the middle, sort of black, a black shirt, I think, maybe. No. And name first, please. No, can you switch? Is it not on?
Green light's on.
Yeah, that's it. That's yep. Fine.
Andy Walker, I actually work in the communications field, but probably quite sympathetic to Greg's position. Given the fact that at the time you were clearly quite sure of your position, and frankly what's happened since, you know, you couldn't have written a book really, I mean, it's an absolute scandal what's developed. Do you regret actually resigning?
Well, I didn't resign, really. The truth. I was told I could either resign or I could be fired. And yeah, I regret not being fired. Because if the staff took to the streets in the numbers they did if I'd resigned, what would they have done if they fired me? However, you could have understood that there would have been a massive, massive constitutional crisis inside the BBC. But, you know, I'm one of those people in life who thinks everything's fine and everything's going to be all right. So it never crossed my mind when I went to work that day that I wouldn't be there that evening. And I wish, yeah, I wish I'd let them fire me. I could probably now take him to court and got a great pile of money as well. But but you can't do that to public institutions, so you... no, I just... It would have been interesting to see, actually, would they have the nerve? I think the answer is probably they would have done. I mean, remember, you had the chairman had gone. You had Lord Ryder, who was a former chief whip, and had about the leadership qualities of my dog. so you had running the place, really, as I say in my book, the posh ladies, you know, who at that time, I have to tell you, there were a few adjectives between the and pod. and one of them certainly came in deciding that night to get rid of me. She never liked me much, and I made it clear I didn't like her a lot. I mean, that's... I mean, a friend of mine came, who's at the London Business School, writing a book about leadership, and said, look, we've got these five qualities, and we think you've got four of them, but you've got none of the other one. And I said, what's the other one? They said, you have to watch your back. And my argument is, you won't get anybody who's got all those four and then watches their back. If you spend your life watching the back, you don't do the other things. You don't take the chances that you need to take. And sometimes they're going to go wrong, and sometimes you may have to go because of this. I mean, what was interesting about this was at the same time as all this was going on, of course, we had the secret policeman. And watching in the weeks before I left, we had letters from about three different chief constables, the head of the Home Office, the Home Secretary, and everybody else saying, this is worse than Gilligan said about how dare you do this, how dare you send someone into them, and the rest of it. And we just sat there and said, I'm sorry, but we don't agree. Now, and of course then the secret policeman came out. But and of course we never heard another word from anybody. But never underestimate what government will do and those authority will do against journalism and against people like the BBC to try to stop things that they think will be embarrassing to them. And that's why, as I said to you, these bust-ups are inevitable. I hope they're not as dramatic as this one, but I hope the next person who sits in the middle of one has more support from his governors than I have. But in the end, they are inevitable, because we play different roles in a democracy. And actually, the need for what we do in the democracy is greater, not less, because the rest of the democratic system, you know, has changed. You know, our democracy has changed fundamentally. We now have presidential government without all the checks and balances that the presidential government system requires.
Next, yeah, there's an arm just in front of you, yeah.
I didn't receive it. It came to the head of news. Yeah.
Sure. Okay. BBC, which then BBC inflamed the situation by responding immediately. Do you think you'd still be at the job if you not responded to that letter immediately?
I'm not sure it would have made any difference. I think Campbell was out of control by then. The Prime Minister told Gavin Davis he thought he was out of control. I mean, what was interesting about it? I mean, why didn't Campbell, when the Prime Minister found out that what Campbell had done in the other dossier, why didn't he fire him? How come you let a bloke and his department steal something off the internet and change it to make it look like Saddam Hussein was funding terrorist groups which they haven't got any evidence for, put it out? And then when they get shown up, they just do nothing. So, no, I think once he'd started the row that day, the row would have gone on. And I think as soon as Dr. Kelly had gone to his boss and said, I think it might be me, but I didn't say that, which, of course, is what they were trying to do, I think then the whole thing was on a course that you couldn't do much about, probably.
Next, there's one right up there in the cheap seats. the front row. Can you see? Yeah.
Hello, my name is Martin Garth.
Hang on. That wasn't the one. Who's speaking?
Oh.
Okay.
I was wondering, could you articulate a little bit more what you meant by the backbenchers had put in enough effort to stop the government's actions when that was the biggest revolt in more than 100 years or so? What else do you think they could have done or should have done?
Well, I think you have to look at what's happened since. There's an awful lot of backbenchers now who are waiting to get re-elected, and they're not going to rock any boat. I think when Butler came out, if you read Butler, it is devastating of the government. They got away with it because Butler said, that John Scarlett should keep his job and the rest of it and the rest of it. And clearly, Butler was trying to deliver a report that got everybody on side, and included amongst them was Ann Taylor, who was a Labour MP and chairman of the Intelligence Committee. But Butler, on any reading, is devastating of the government. It makes it very clear that the intelligence was sexed up. And I just think watching Ann Taylor that day baying at Michael Howard, I thought was unacceptable. These people, we live in a democracy where one of the jobs of the legislature is to question the executive. When you get majorities of 180, and 200 people are now on the 200 MPs are now one way or another on the government payroll, and the whole future is dependent upon pleasing. It's a system of patronage, pleasing two or three people. You don't get the scrutiny that you should get. Now, when you get majorities of 10 and 15 and 20, you can get the scrutiny. When you get majorities of 180 or so, you don't get it. They should have read Butler properly, understood what it meant, and said to the Prime Minister, you should go.
Was it Martin Garside whom I interrupted? Sorry, because I hadn't seen you with the mic.
I don't know, so. What would you say is the one positive thing that happens with the BBC essentially?
Well, the positive thing that happened as a result of the departure is I think the government, who at one time were in danger of falling for the stuff they were getting from the commercial sector and all the newspapers about doing something serious to the BBC, I think that's gone away in charter renewal. I think the BBC will now get a decent charter. There'll be a bits, and they'll have to be seen to be bits, you know. And I do think they'll change the system of governments, although Michael Grade is striking, I think, working pretty hard not to. I don't quite understand why, but all chairmen of the BBC within a start off saying, is this the right system? And within a relatively short period of time, end up defending the system of governance. People always said to me, why didn't you say this when you were there? And I said it regularly there, but I think you can't say it publicly. These people employ you. So I think actually the result of the whole thing is that there will be a decent result from charter renewal, which there needs to be. We need to understand how important the BBC is in this society. We spend more money in Britain on original television programme per head of the population than in any other country in the world. Because of it, we have a broadcasting system that by and large reflects our society and our culture. The commercial sector does not wish that to continue. And it only continues. Why does ITV spend twice as much on original programming than any other commercial broadcaster in Europe? Because they have to compete with the BBC. Now, over decades, we've taken a decision in this country that we will spend £2.5 billion a year of licence fee money on a broadcasting system which reflects our society and our culture. That becomes more important in a fragmented commercial world, not less. And I think that's the good thing that will come out of it. The BBC will, by and large, remain intact.
Eager hand, just down here.
John Burris for ex-BBC. I'm bringing your book this morning. A question vital to your health and happiness. How's the diet going?
I've just gone back on it again yesterday. I've stopped drinking. It's the month I stopped drinking, and I do that as an opportunity to go back on the diet. It was all right. I carried on with the Atkins. I got back on the Atkins. For those who haven't read the book, I was in the middle of the Atkins diet when all this stuff hit, and I kept going, and I kept going, and I kept going. And then on the night they decided they didn't want me anymore, I ate a pizza and drank a bottle of wine. Actually, in the book it says I drank half a bottle of wine because when somebody read it, they said, I think that makes you look like an alcoholic if you put a bottle of wine. But I did drink the whole bottle of wine.
Yeah, one just up. Yeah, on the edge there.
Hi, my name is Raymond Mark from the University of Westminster. We have a crisis at the moment with our university union where we elect the president each year and they have their own ideals. They implement them to whatever effect and then they bugger off. You obviously, with the general BBC, you did a lot of good things. Do you still have a relationship with the BBC in any sort of advisory effect to help them progress, or have you said it all ties?
I've severed all ties. It's not fair on your successor, in all honesty. You have to let your successor get on with it. I think Mark is a good bloke. I won't agree with all he does, but I think your job when you've gone is you shut up. It's not my job to say, I don't mind talking about the stuff I did when I was there, but now it's his time, and your time is then to, it's a bit like you and your predecessor, really, you know. The world of television is a very world, very funny world. It's full of old, former television executives who go whinge on about, oh, it's not as good when I was young. I think it's all about their libido. I don't think it's got anything whatsoever to do with the television. I think they think back to these wonderful days when they pulled all these women, and they don't do it anymore because they're about 80. But they do whinge on. And of course, the newspapers can always find them. So you saw the one the other day where they managed to drag out of somewhere Alistair Mill. Now, Alistair's a nice bloke, right? But he's a long while out of the BBC. And yet his decision was not only had television gone down the tubes, the BBC television stations had gone down the tubes, but it was all the fault of the fact that women now ran them. Now, in all honesty, so I think your job when you've gone is to shut up, really. Now, I can't shut up about this because I'm trying to make a difference on the point, but I think your job about the policy is to say not a lot.
There's a question from a woman there in the second row from the back, or third row from the back. Yep. It's you. And then the one directly in front. Go ahead. Are you? Carry on. Yes, you.
I'm Caroline Atkinson from an independent journalism training centre in Islington. Do you think good training is essential to producing a good journalist?
Yeah, because there's basic rudimentary things you've got to know. And actually, one of the possibilities is that the expansion of outlets in a comparatively short period of time has meant that some people working there have not done that essential training that they should have done. But absolutely, it is. It's absolutely essential. It's essential because it's only when you join the BBC. I mean, I was thinking yesterday about the fuss over Kilroy. Because, you know, I love to watch what's happened to him since. I think it's even funnier than when we got rid of him.
You're presumably voting UKIP, aren't you?
He's not with UKIP anymore.
Right.
No, he's now Kilroy. He's just gone back to being Kilroy. But that debate that went on over Kilroy said, basically, I'm an individual. I'm entitled to have my opinion and put them on the telly. Well, I'm sorry, you're not. If you become a BBC presenter, and you become a BBC journalist, that's not what you're entitled to do. You give some of those things up if you take that job. And that, I think, you have to make sure. I mean, I had a wonderful moment on the phone. I was in the car on the phone to a presenter on one of the 24-hour news stations. And they said to me, well, I'm not sure I agree with that. And I just unbugged it. I said, listen, I don't give a toss whether you agree or don't agree. What do you know about it? And, of course, that was the end of it, because he didn't know anything about it. He knew nothing at all. He's 92nd interviewee of the day. Now, what you have got to, therefore, do is teach people what their role is. And their role is to try to extract information from other people, but I'm not interested in their opinions.
One directly in front, actually. Yeah.
I should tell you straight, I am going to do nothing. Worse would happen, I suspect. I mean, I read that Alistair Campbell wants to become a Labour MP. Then I think there has to be... I don't think you should object to him. He is a brilliant operator. He's a good press guy. He's actually a nice bloke. But he goes bonkers at times. I don't think it's one of the great scandals of our time that he goes back into Milbank or wherever it is they're going to run the election from and advises them at the time of the election. I think that's what, I don't mind that, that's what a democracy is about.
We'll take a couple more, I think. One blue shirt and then a green shirt. Well, we'll take both of them together and then we'll...
What do you think would have happened if the Gilligan report had gone out on Channel 4 or the ITV?
To pass it, we'll have two together.
It wouldn't have been noticed. It wouldn't have been noticed. Actually, if you watch Channel 4 News, which I think is actually an extremely good news programme, but I mean, it does quite much, much tougher things than Gilligan's report quite regularly. I mean, if you watch them on the day Butler came out, where they devoted half the programme to interviewing the parents of people killed in Iraq, I mean, you can't get more emotive than that. No, you've got to understand it's about the relationship. Well, first of all, it was the relationship between Campbell and the Today programme, which they hated. Then it's about the relationship between Campbell and Gilligan, who he used to call Gullible Gilligan, because Gilligan used to keep getting good stories about the defence. You see, most defence journalists, you know, they're army people. Gilligan wasn't. He was a defence journalist who found out real stories about. I mean, he actually showed that the bombing of Kosovo was a complete waste of time, you know. Or the anyway, it wouldn't have been noticed. It's about the relationship. The governments of the day think they own the BBC.
Hello, Roger Lawman, working in the commercial media sector. Mr. Blair is likely to be defined today in history as his forays into Iraq.
I keep my partner was asking me that the other day. I mean, I've discovered this wonderful thing, like, you know, when you resign, politicians resign and say, I want to spend more time with my family. Well, I've discovered that my family don't want to spend that much more time with me. I was getting this question the other day, do you think it's now time you got another job? And I said, no, I quite like, you know, getting up and sitting around and not doing a lot. Well, I wrote for 4 months, you know, non-stop. I don't know what I'll do next. It's quite tough, really. First of all, there are those who say, well, you know you won't get another job anyway if you're that rude about the Prime Minister. To which I say, so luckily I made a lot of money at one stage in my life, so it doesn't matter. And secondly, I then say, well, what sort of society is it now when if you criticise the Prime Minister, you don't get a job? But much more than that is, I'm not sure what job I want to do. I don't want to...
Yeah,
I could stand as an independent. That would last about a week, I think, you know.
Well, we're going to take one more question. Woman over there in the red shirt.
Well, many things, pleasure to do so. Greg, I heard you say on Frost as well, and you every time you say it, the second time you say it, you say it so fast, but I only just captured it. You say you don't think the Prime Minister lies. And I really just wondered whether you're saying that in the media line.
God. If I'd taken the legal advice, we'd never got the book out, I can tell you. That's not what I am. Listen, I've offended enough people. I might as well just offend the Prime Minister as well. I think he feels pretty offended anyway. But then so do I. So, I mean, that's both of us. I think to say the Prime Minister lied, you've got to have the evidence to demonstrate he lied, and that evidence isn't available. What is available is that he didn't scrutinise a lot of information he should have scrutinised. There is no doubt in my mind that he took us to war on the wrong basis and that he decided to go to war anyway. But I don't think that's the same thing as saying he lied. And I don't, unless you can demonstrate, I don't think it matters if you want my honest opinion. I think we're talking about competence here, not about mistakes. But if you're going to say he lied, you have to be able to show it quite clearly. And all the evidence that went to Hutton showed that certain people... I mean, Alistair Campbell lied. No doubt about that. He lied to the Foreign Affairs Committee. That's clear. You can show that from the evidence to Hutton. But if you're going to say the Prime Minister lied, you have to be able to produce the evidence to show he lied. And I thought Michael Howard made a mistake when he started accusing the Prime Minister of lying, because I think it's too easy. The charge against the Prime Minister is much more devastating than that. I think the Prime Minister told us what he believed to be the position. What he didn't do was ask the questions of that position. And I think he actually, as I said earlier, I think he created the position himself by deciding this was going to happen. There was a very interesting New York Times piece this week. It was reprinted, I think, either in the Sunday Times or the Observer yesterday, about George Bush. And you could have been reading about Tony Blair. I mean, in the sense of, once a decision is taken, he believed, it's that sort of religious zealotry. You know, he believed. He was brilliant at it. He's a great speaker, I think, Blair. He's a brilliant. But when he said, you know, I must tell you. I mean, certainly when he said, I know things that I can't tell you, you can now show quite clearly that came from a briefing by Dearlove, who was the head of MI6 at the time, and Dearlove told him, we've got this new piece of evidence, which was all later withdrawn because it was bullshit, we've got this new piece of evidence that shows that Saddam's weapons program is being expanded. And Dearlove said at the same time, but you must know, you must realise, this is from an unproven source. And Blair and Campbell both sat in the meeting. Interesting. You only work that out if you read both. I'm a nerd on this stuff, right? But if you have to read Hutton and Butler to find out they were both at the meeting. They both sat there. They both took that piece of information away. That's why they wrote it into the introduction, so it hardened up the introduction to the dossier. That's why they then said, that Blair then said, I know things you don't know. Now, I don't think that comes to lying, but I do think it comes to gross incompetence.
Great, thank you very much. We've had some good questions as well from the House, which means I should thank you as well. Greg's going to sign a few books upstairs or in the circle, and I can say, and I'm not getting a cut, that it is an extremely good read. That's my role this evening.
Okay, I'll pay you now or I'll pay you later.
Thank you very much. Some very interesting questions, very interesting answers.